You are listening to Punk News Podcast 452. This episode is going to be a bummer, so let's just get it over with. Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile. I'm here with Adam White. Adam White, we got a lot of not fun topics to talk about today, but we got to talk about them. I'm feeling down about some of my musical guys that I really respect. I'm feeling down. I'm feeling bad, and I'm worried about them. And it was kind of a bummer week music-wise, but, you know, I mean, that's a part of life. Like with Greek theater, for every comedy, you have to have a tragedy. For every tragedy, you have to have a comedy. Adam White, though, should we just force it and try to be jolly gaggers, or should we talk about the sad topics and just, you know, give them a Cure type album podcast wise?
I mean, what do people want to listen to? Do people want to use this podcast as the cathartic, as a means of expressing their inner teenage angst and, you know, all the loves they've never been able to acquire? Like, I don't know, John. What is the purpose of this bummer podcast for people? What should keep people from going to that delete button and just dragging the whole thing into the trash? What are we giving to them?
I'll tell you what we're giving to them. And actually, I've been thinking about this all week, and I was thinking about this specifically today. In that we are giving you the Punk News Podcast listenership. We are not giving you press releases and just spouting out press releases. We are not talking about just what, you know, fun stuff, which is usually press release kind of stuff. We're talking about what's real and what's affecting the punk scene today. And hopefully we can find some enlightenment. I don't know by what degree, but maybe some degree of enlightenment. Or if not that, then at least we can be part of a wider conversation. And I don't know, maybe help people come to their own conclusions on things. That's always my point of the podcast. So, you know, sometimes punk isn't fun, you know, and a lot of people see punk as an escape, but it's also dealing with reality. So,
yeah, so get ready for 16 stories about Woodstock.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. People are like, why are you talking about Woodstock? Why are you talking about Woodstock? And actually, I'm starting to feel bad for talking about Woodstock because, I mean, honestly, like, at first I thought it was funny, but I don't really enjoy in reveling in other people's misery. And the Woodstock guy seems like kind of a knob, but I don't know if he's a bad guy, you know, so I don't know. Like, I feel it's bad mojo to like just continually beat down on someone that's having a tough time, you know. But on the other hand, though, people are like, why are you talking about Woodstock? You know, I just want to hear about what new songs are coming out. So what you're saying is I want to be treated like a product or no, I want to be treated like a consumer of a product. And that's all I want to be treated. That is saying I just want to be treated like the cog, a cog in the, you know, what's the word looking for? Marketing path, and that's all. I basically want to be treated as an object, not as a person that might be interested outside of things dealing with
financial. Hold on. So people who don't want to hear you talk incessantly about Woodstock are people that want to be treated like objects.
Exactly. Precisely. I'm glad you can sum it up that way.
All right then. So we know where you stand on that. All right. So before we get into whatever crap we have to talk about this week, any mail?
Yes, two letters, and also Tom Trom is not with us this week. And I always enjoy the Adam and John podcast greatly, but unfortunately this one's kind of a bummer, so what are you going to do? You can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. This is from just Mike. Here's what Mike says. You finally figured out how to do regular updates. That is very good. Now maybe you can start doing preparation before the recording. I'm kidding. I listen every week. From Mike.
No. Yeah, you know what? Once we start this this Patreon that we're probably not actually starting, what we should do, that should be like one of the goal, one of those goals. Like once we've reached like $50 a month, we will prep for 10 minutes before we do each show.
I approve. This is from Red Skull's Red Skull's Boner, Adam. I have a question about different versions of records. I've started buying records. I see people paying twice and three times as much for European and Japan pressings compared to American pressings. Someone on Discogs paid $100 for a Japanese version of the Clash self-titled album. I paid $20 at my local shop. Why do people pay more? Is just because it says France at the bottom? What is the purpose? From Red Skull's Boner.
On the one hand, I agree with the confusion in that I'm not totally sure. I'm not really sure why you would want to acquire one from a different country. And I know that there are sometimes slight. I mean, it's funny that he brought up the Clash's first record, so we'll put that aside for a sec. But the there are sometimes like slight artistic variants and things like that, but like not in a way that would matter. Like I bought a Canadian pressing of the first Devo record at a record show a few months ago, and I mean, it has a, you know, there's a tiny maple leaf on it at some point that they've just sort of integrated into the artwork, and I don't know why. It was just something the record company put there to help say that this was from the Canadian label and not its US counterpart. But it's an identical record. And I didn't buy it because it was the Canadian copy. I'm just like, I'm in Canada, and that was what the guy was selling. But the Fat First Clash record is actually maybe a good example of one of the ones that chasing foreign variants of it might make sense, because there are actual real differences in that. I mean, not even taking into account the fact that that record, you know, in the US version of it that was released like a year or so later, has a totally different track listing and omitted songs or added songs. Like, you know, was White Man and Hammersmith Pele?
Man on Hammersmith is US version, not UK
version. Right. Like, it was a UK single that came out after the first Clash record, and then it got incorporated into it. And songs like, I think, Protex Blue got taken off the US one. But in any case, that major change aside, the Canadian version of the first Clash record, like, differs from the US version in some, I guess, I don't know if this is significant, but like a more significant, say, artistic way than that Devo example I brought up, in which the coloring on the Canadian pressing of the first Clash LP is blue as opposed to green in the States. So like, I could see going and getting, you know, if you're a big collector guy, like getting those types of variants, because it's a little bit more interesting. But if the only difference is that like the UPC code, the barcode on there is different, and that there's like a different, some different scratchings in the run out. I don't know who that appeals to. I'm not
Beatles
totally
guys,
sure.
Man. Beatles guys love that stuff.
I mean, once I'm aware of it, I kind of want to know which one I have. So I don't know if that's like starting down the road, because like I'll go take a record that I have and go to put it into Discogs. And especially if it's some older major label release, it sometimes takes you half an hour to figure out which fucking version of the record you have, because you're trying to, you know, ascertain all these little details to figure out like, oh, I don't actually have, you know, the 1984 pressing from this plant. I have the 1985 pressing from this plant or something, right? Because like people do detail all that shit. So once I'm actually looking at it, I think it's kind of interesting to figure out which one I have, but I don't know. I can't foresee a moment where I would walk into a record store and go and try to find the other ones. But then again, I'm not the kind of person that goes and buys color variant of vinyls, like a color variant of records either. So I'm probably not the right one to know. I'd be curious if Ricky would do our past co-host Ricky, because Ricky seems like the kind of guy that when he's really in collector mode, you know, he's going to go and he's going to get the blue splatter variant of the Pears record, and then he's going to get the red transparent version of the Pears record or whatever. So would he go in and get, you know, the Turkish version that's the exact same, except it was released by like Fat Records Turkey instead of Fat Records US? That's what I want to know.
Like I said, with Beatles collectors, like they'll collect a different pressing just because it says like, you know, 0518 instead of 0517 on the matrix. Like they'll collect everything. For me, sometimes, there is slight sound differences, or some people think there's slight sound differences between Japanese, European, and American, or we can say a Western Hemisphere. And Western Hemisphere are hypothetically the second worst sound, with the worst being like Africa and India and South America, which are considered the worst sounds. The quote reason behind that is that this is at least in the 70s, rather, the pressing plates were first used in Japan, then sent over to Europe, then sent over to the Western Hemisphere for pressing records. Whether or not that's true, who knows? The Japanese famously use very high quality, pure, actual vinyl, which is an explanation as to why Japanese records are kind of highly desirable. But I mean, depending on your system, you might not really hear a difference at all. I think the more interesting difference is a couple. Is depending on certain countries, sometimes the actual songs or sound recording or mastering is different. Of course, with AC/DC, the early Australian albums are way different than the albums released outside of Australia, even though they have the same title. Also, AC/DC has, I think it's a Netherlands or maybe Swedish. There's a version of High Voltage, no, not High Voltage. There's a version of Powerage where the actual mastering is way different, so the record sounds way different. With Rolling Stone English presses and American presses up until their Satanic Majesties, the track listings were actually completely different and they had different songs. So that's something people like to look out for. But also a big part of it is just, you know, like, why do people collect collector's plates? Like, you don't really do anything with it, you look at it. So I think that's why some people collect, like, say, Japanese pressings or whatever. You know.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those places where like you can go further down the line towards being super ridiculous about it, but then once you're at that line, you probably just got to cross it. And I imagine that a lot of the times the collector's market starts to thin out at a certain point where There's things that are obviously very collectible, and then there's things that are only of interest to super nerds, right? And on that super nerds level, you may not actually find that you're spending all that much money to get, like, you know, the answer is that it isn't strange, right? To get like boring, like pedantic variants of records from flea market sellers or whatever like that. So it just might just be like a thing that you're doing.
And yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, if the one thing that kind of keeps you off the edge is that you have to buy, you know, 300 different versions of Marquee Moon and they're all the same, well then, you know, Godspeed.
For some reason, there's a lot of like cheap Korean record. Like, I've got a bunch of Elton John Korean records that I got for like $3 each, and they're just kind of fun to have. I mean, they're really crappy sound quality and cover, but the cover's like a little different, you know. So that's just kind of fun to have, you know. One of the biggest, I guess, most desirable, I guess, weird pressings is there's an Iranian pressing of Hawkwind Silver Machine, which goes for like $5,000 just because, like, it's rare to have an Iranian record, particularly a space rock Iranian record, you know.
That is a thing that sounds rare.
I mean, I guess Persian's the right term, not Iranian, Persian, I should say, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're talking about the, I guess, like the ethnicity of the record, which you're not, what year would that album have come out?
It's a single. It's like 1973, 1972, something like that.
So when was the revolution? I'm blanking. 79, right?
So that
makes sense because, you know, that things are much different within Iran before then. It was a more Western liberal kind of place. They were probably like just awash in Hawkwind.
Adam, did you ever see like photos of Iran like before the revolution, like at the beach? It's like crazy.
Yeah, it was a pretty different place before and after.
I mean, it looks like Italy, you know, like with all the haircuts and or maybe like Spain, like with the haircuts and the bikinis. It's crazy. Anyway, we're not here to sort out international politics, except we are. Let's play a song, Adam. You don't play a song. You want me to play a song?
Unless I can throw one in, unless you have one right at the tip of your fingers.
I do not have one at the tip of my fingers. Do you?
Yeah, sure. I got a couple. So let's play. I say that and then I pause, like as if I didn't. Okay. So there is a synth heavy noise punk band from Toronto, of course, called Eyeballs. They have a new 2-song single that is online. It features the songs Weightlifting and Woke Up Like This. The new tracks are the band's first recordings since 2016, when they released a full length called Bad Art. And Weightlifting is going to appear on an upcoming EP that they have called Fun Hell, not From Hell, Fun, F-U-N, Hell. This is a 2-piece band. It's got Jen on vocal, synth, and drums, Britton on vocals, synth, drums, and bass. This song has an extra guest on there who's providing some vocals and is playing, to be super, super specific, a Korg Castellator synth. And it's super fun and weird. So this is a song from Eyeballs. It's called Weightlifting. It is eventually going to be on the Fun Hell EP, whenever the heck that comes out. And it's cool. So here you go.
And that was Eyeballs. Adam, that EYEBAWLS.
E-Y-E-B-A-L-L-S.
Oh, okay. I think there's another band called B-A-W-L-S.
But like Balling? Dude. No.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet you there are like 300 bands called Eyeballs.
Honestly, a lot of interesting synth punks bands right now. I might play one later. A lot of them are pretty aggressive sounding, and synth punk is in. What can we say? Anyway, speaking of things that are not in, Rob Miller. He is not in right now, let me tell you. Of course, Rob Miller, along with his brother, founded Amoebix. Amoebix is one of the most seminal punk/metal bands ever. I think their influence is actually understated, because before Amoebix, the only band that crossed over punk and metal was Motorhead, and Motorhead kind of pushed it away from both punk and metal, saying, "Oh, we're just a rock band." And pretty much the whole punker in a biker jacket with spikes. That's Amoebix. You know, that's not Crass. That's not Sex Pistols. That's Amoebix. The whole neo-pagan thing, that's Amoebix. The whole kind of dark metal, grimy metal, that's Amoebix. And not that they're only influential. All three of their albums, but especially the first one, Arise, are simply amazing albums. Amoebix broke up in, I think, 88. Maybe it was 87. They reformed in 2008 and broke up again in 2012. Rob Miller kind of went quiet for a little while, and then he appeared. About 2 or 3 years later, he appeared with his band, Tal Cross. Tal Cross is Rob Miller, Andy Lefton, Michael Langevin, John Misery, and a couple other guys that kind of floated in and out of the band, but those are the four main guys. They put out 2 albums so far. Those albums were – the first one was really good. Second one was pretty good. Their third one was supposed to come out August of this year, Relapse. I had pre-ordered it. I got the Mega Deluxe version. I was excited. They released a single. Everyone was excited. Then out of the blue, Tal Cross posted on their Facebook, "It's not coming out on Relapse anymore. We'll let you know what's going to happen." And a lot of people were extremely surprised. Adam, I don't know about you, but I assumed it was like a money issue. You know, that's what I thought. I don't know if you had a thought on that or
the first statement that they released did not it didn't let on that there is a super controversy broiling about this. It seemed very sort of matter of fact, and it seemed fairly, deferential to Relapse. Like it wasn't terse. It wasn't, we had a falling out or something like that. It's just like, it's not coming out on Relapse, but you know what, we love them. Good relationship, extend our gratitude, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a little bit, it buried the lead a bit.
Yeah, well, I was bummed out, but I'm a guy, I'll hear one way or another. But then the next day, shit hit the fan. There's no other way to say it. Basically, Relapse, I believe, was the first to post a statement. And basically, here's what they said. They said Rob Miller thanked a guy called Gerard Menuhin in the credits. Like, you say, thank mom, dad. He also thanked this guy, Gerard Menuhin, for inspiration. Adam, I'd never heard of this guy before this past week. Had you?
Nope. And I think neither had most of the band.
Yeah. Well, exactly. So anyway, as it turns out, Gerard Menuhin, he's a Holocaust denier. He published a book in 2015 called Something, and basically denying the Holocaust. An interesting thing about this guy, Gerard Menuhin, his father, well, he's Jewish himself, or at least he was born Jewish. I don't know if he's Jewish now. His father is Jewish, or was Jewish. Well, it was Jewish because he's deceased. But he's an extremely famous violin player, to the extent that there's a bunch of foundations under his name as a violin player to promote the violin arts. And Gerard Menuhin, he's got brothers and sisters that don't talk to him that kind of like curate the violin kind of thing, which kind of blew my mind that he's Jewish. And not only that, his dad's a famous violin player. Like his dad isn't like the world's most famous violin player, but if it was punk, his dad would be like Agent Orange or like I'm trying to think of another example, like Battalion of Saints, like well known, in violin, which is kind of weird. So I don't know how you go from being a violin player to being like a huge bigot. Anyways, as it turns out, Gerard Menuhin wrote this book, and he's got like some online presence too and stuff, that basically denying the Holocaust. Now, I don't know if he's a Holocaust denier in the concept that he denies the Holocaust ever took place, or I don't know if he's a Holocaust denier in that he says there was a war, but it wasn't, quote, Germany's fault. I didn't want to look into it because I don't really care one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, the detail I think that is important here is that whatever he wrote in this book, which, again, we're not super interested in, you cannot purchase it in Germany because it violates enough of their laws about this kind of stuff that it is forbidden there.
So anyway, Relapse said, we spoke to Rob Miller. He says he's not a Holocaust denier, but he was influenced by Gerard Menowin. So we can't put this album out anymore. And I think they already pressed the record at him, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the band was completely caught off guard. They had no idea. Like, they saw his name, but they just thought it was just some dude, because why wouldn't you? You know what I mean? And so, like, the label was caught way off guard because they hadn't heard of the guy. The band was caught way off guard because they hadn't heard of the guy. And everyone was real shooken up. And Rob Miller kind of went silent for, like, a day or two. And then he released a statement. And basically, in his statement, it didn't do him any favors. Basically, he said he said, yes, I did thank Gerard Menowin, and I like his book. And he wrote in this kind of this vague style. He didn't say that he was a Holocaust denier, but he basically said that there's a bunch of lies about a lot of things out there, and I'm searching for the truth, and I can't turn away if I come upon unpleasant truths, if they're the truth, is essentially what he said. You know?
The statement is something that people should read. That and the follow-up statement, because he is florid in this. The statement that Miller puts out is... I mean, I don't want to say it reads almost biblical, but it is a pronouncement by someone that is trying to linguistically put themselves on a different plane of conversation than everyone else is having the conversation on.
And he's also being frustratingly vague. He's not taking points head on. You know?
Yeah, it's a strange statement because, and in the one sense, it's kind of refreshing, because usually when you see someone's career sort of blow up in a big controversy like this, that they approach it from the, we're going to have a crisis management communications team come in and help us write the diffusing statement that says all the right things to try to minimize the career impact of this. And Miller basically like emerges from a cave wearing a wizard robe and starts shooting lightning out of a staff. And it is a strange way to approach it. And it's worth reading. He's calling other people in the band Judas.
Well, that's his second statement.
That's the second one that gets way further out there. But yeah, and that might just be the way that Miller approaches the world. I don't know.
Adam, you hit on a very good point where you say he's emerging from a cave. And this is not secret knowledge, but not that many people know this. So Rob Miller is from England. About 10 or 15 years ago, he moved up to North Scotland, where nobody lives. Right? And he's been living up there like in a hut ever since, making swords. Like, honestly, if you've seen like Gladiator, he probably made that sword. Like, for a little while, I don't know about now, but for a little while, he was the only guy on the planet that made swords in the traditional style, that is, without modern techniques that like Vikings would have done or whatever. I don't know if he's still that way, but like he's highly respected in making swords. Like, he's the sword guy, or he wasn't. You know, the sword community probably doesn't even know about this, honestly.
This reads like a statement from someone that owns their own forge.
Right, but the other side of that is he's been extremely secluded for a long time. And he and I've interviewed him a bunch of times, and we talked about this on the first and second Tao Cross album. And I don't know if he's always been in Gnosticism, but more and more he's been getting into Gnosticism and studying it. And I don't know if the listeners know what Gnosticism is. Gnosticism is this weird, I guess, religion or belief system. It actually kind of sprung from Christianity, but it's not a Christianity belief system. It's basically a belief that all reality is a lie. We don't actually exist, and we're just a projection of some other entity that might not even know it exists, that didn't create the universe, that another entity created that entity, but the second entity thinks it creates the universe even though it didn't. That's Gnosticism in a nutshell. And the idea behind that is that nothing exists, and you should always search for the truth because most things out there are a lie. And on the first and second Tao Cross album, he talked about how, you know, cable news, major news networks, they're filled with lies, which is kind of true. I mean, if you watch Fox and CNN, somebody's lying a lot, you know, and maybe they both are. So I'm like, yeah, it's pretty interesting. I don't believe the Gnosticism thing. But, you know, it's an interesting artistic device, if you will, you know. And then he issues his second statement, Adam. And the second statement, he came off as more unhinged. He called Andy Lefton a Judas, which really surprised me. And basically he said, you kids have created a hierarchy of victimhood, desperately scrambling for status on the ladder of the imaginary oppressed. Nice kitchen block. Basically, he's saying that you all that are saying you're offended are whiners and victims, and you are chained by the shackles of falsehood, and I'm clutching for the truth. And you might not like the truth, but I'm looking for the truth, and even if it's not nice, you have to deal with it. Tellingly, he doesn't back down from the men and women thing, and he comes across as very angry against his bandmates, which is very unfortunate. Because I know Andy Lefton. I mean, I'm not like friends with him, but we're friendly acquaintances. And Adam, he's just a dude. Like he's in War Plague, which is a well-known crust punk band. But he's a dude. He's an artist. Like he makes like videos and stuff. He's just a nice dude, you know. And I feel really bad for Andy. Like Adam, it'd be like if like Devo called you up and said, Adam, make our website, and you're like, yeah, Devo, this will be awesome. We'll make a website together. And then like Mark Mothersbaugh is like, Adam's an asshole. I hate him. Also, Martians rule the world. You know what I mean? So, but I've got a hot take. I don't know if you've got a stance, but basically all the crust punkers and all the punkers are like, Rob Miller's a jerk. We hate him. He's a Nazi, or he's Nazi associated. Amoebix is over. Tau Cross is over. It's all gone to shit. And also, what is no one saw? I saw a funny tweet, and the funny tweet was that like, oh, look, another anti-Semitic statement again from Squint's Eyes. Amoebix? You know, no one saw this coming, because Amoebix is all about, you know, like not being oppressed and fighting against, you know, oppressing forces, you know.
So I think I actually have a take on this that is.
Do we have the same hot take and not know it?
Maybe. So I have two takes on this. The one of them is maybe not super interesting, and I'll save it until we get into it. But, so basically the not interesting take, and I can come back to that, is that I mean, I feel like I can't really fault the label for what they did here. And I don't read what the label did as some form of, speech oppression or anything like that. Cause that seems to be the angle that you usually take on these things. If you want, I can kind of come at it from that. But what I think is
I mean, listen, you have to draw the line somewhere, and saying the Holocaust didn't happen, I think.
No, right. However, it's just
go ahead, but I think the label actually did get it wrong a little bit. But go ahead.
Well, just my I guess I'll get into this a little bit. My sympathy for the label is that, and really like for the other guys in the band as well, is that when you look at what a label is in 2019, that the definition is increasingly vague. Like the necessity of what a label is for is increasingly vague, because you can get a lot of media out there into the world on your own. And it's not quite the same as having a label be a bank, which is maybe how it was in most of the, in the 90s and maybe the early 2000s. Right. But one of the big things that a label still is within certain fan bases is that it is a reputational what's the word I'm looking for? It is a reputational boost for you as the artist, right? So if you are a person that is a fan of the catalog of Relapse Records, having a record come out on that label is meaningful to you. We've actually talked about this before, because I think who was it? Liverpool Neil had written us in and asked like why I have such a focus on labels sometimes, and really like that's it. So I'm a big fan of Mint Records out of Vancouver, and if Mint is going to go put out a band, I may not have ever heard that band before, but I am maybe more inclined to go check it out because I like most of the other stuff that Mint has put out, and that matters, right? So if you look at like the one thing that a label has that's really important to it is reputation, right? Is the cool of the label, is what the label represents. So if all of a sudden the label ends up dragged into the mud because of being associated with something like Holocaust denial, or if the label comes off as being too like hair splitty defensive of something like this, well, then the label is all of a sudden potentially torching like the one thing it has going for it, which is its name. So, you know, if a label all of a sudden kills its reputation, it doesn't really matter how adept they are at, you know, all the boring stuff, putting out press releases and getting the masters to the pressing plant, whatever the fuck else a label does, right? Like, none of that matters. No one's using a label because the label is efficient or is run practically. They're on a label because the label is cool. And so, you know, losing your cool for a label is sort of like a death knell for it. So I get why I get why that they would want to get out ahead of it and go like, whoa. Okay. We are out. We are not on this. Even if they had pressed the records, right? Because then the next band they want to go work with is going to be like, well, hold on. You're the label that was defending the Holocaust denial stuff. And even if it's not true, but it sticks to them, it could totally fuck with that label's viability going forward. So I get that. And I get why they would want to jump out ahead of it and maybe just disassociate themselves as much as possible because they risk all of that. Right. So that I get, it's almost like, John, if we went and we hired someone that was going to be the new, interviews editor at Punk News, and they're just some rando on the internet, cause that's what we all are. And then all of a sudden they did something super reprehensible. We would probably tire pretty quickly of having Punk News and ourselves associated with whatever reprehensible thing that this dude said. It would just be something that would be, it would start to be stuck to us and we wouldn't be able to do much about it. But then we'd go approach someone to act as Punk News and people would be like, whoa, no, Punk News was, they were involved in that guy that liked, peeing in cereal boxes. How could you, right? And then be like, no, that wasn't us. That was the reviews guy. We have nothing to do with him or whatever, right? So I can see why that matters. But here's my thing that I think is a hot take, and I wonder if this is your hot take. I am willing to bet that Rob Miller is not a Holocaust denier. And I am willing to bet that I'm willing to take at face value his argument that, you know what, I don't care about the Holocaust denial parts of this guy's philosophy. I care about some other shit that he wrote in a book that was very meaningful to me. Like, I'm willing to take that as face value and believe it. And for the reason being is that he seems like the kind of person that would stubbornly make that distinction without, without much of a care for the fact that the rest of the world isn't going to understand, but he knows that, like, by his own sort of like
code,
by his own like self-righteous understanding of how the universe works, he can walk that line. And like, if he is into Gnosticism and he, I mean, you can see it in his statement, all this crap that he's writing about like the truth, right? And like half the words here half the words in his statement are capitalized because he's putting extra meaning into them, right? Prisons and truth and all this kind of stuff, right? Like, this dude is out on his own branch of the tree, right? So I've met people like this in life where they, you know, where they will latch on to some point that you could on paper understand that, okay, you know, it's like someone that's going to go buy, like, okay, yeah, here's an example, right? I've known like history students that would, I don't know if any of them actually did this, but they were the type, right? Where they would say, like, go and acquire and own a copy of, say, like, Mein Kampf, right? and read it. And
well, that's not weird, Adam. I mean,
but here's what they would do. They would own it, and then they would say, like, take it, and they would put it on the bookshelf with their other books. And most other people would be like, whoa, A, why do you own that? And B, like, why is it being displayed? Like, that's a bad thing. But the people are going to approach it, and they're going to say, like, look, I'm secure enough in my own shit that I don't actually believe this. I'm approaching it as a historical document, and it's on the bookshelf because it's a fucking book, and that's where books go. When I want to find the book, I go to the bookshelf, and it's there under M or H or whatever, right? Like, they would make that kind of argument, and then they would fight for that argument because they would approach it and being like you, they would say, like, you who is bothered by this are being bothered by it because you were not secure enough in whatever, right? They would go off in that kind of argument. But then they would dig in, right? And then you start digging in about the fact that you know, you're not going to change your life because everyone else has a problem with something. And, you know that you're not, that you're not actually approaching it in the way that is problematic, right? You're not owning this book because you believe it. You're owning it for all these other reasons or whatever, right? So I could totally see it. You just read Miller's statement, and it reads like the statement of one of these people that is going to take some stance, reputation be damned, and they know that they're fucking right, or at least like not. Not that they are right in terms of, they know that they are right, right? They know that on some hair splitting level, based on their read of the situation, they're not doing anything wrong. And the fact that you don't see that isn't their problem. So fuck you. Right. And that's how Miller's statement reads to me. He reads like one of those people. And usually when I've met those people, they're not evil, right? They're not actually, like, I believe them when they say that I'm going to live my life according to this stubborn code. What these people are is, like, completely numb to how the rest of society actually sees what they're doing or what they're engaging in. And they're not willing, for whatever reason, to curb whatever behavior that they're doing for the sake of the perception of everyone else, because they see that as their freedom is being trampled by something that doesn't matter, right? And, you know, and then that, and again, like, that's how Miller's stuff reads to me. It is a totally, like, I guess antisocial is the word for it, right? It's a stubborn antisocial way of going about your life. And it leads to situations where all of a sudden you're a pariah because, you know, everyone else isn't seeing the situation on your level, but you know, that's the road that you've gone down, and you're probably pretty much happy to, you're happy to be sticking to your point more than you are to be liked. And I don't know, that's how Miller's stuff reads to me. Now, it could be, and then that's the exact kind of person that would take this potentially controversial figure, or take this obviously controversial figure, either not realize that they are controversial and then include them in your thank you notes, or you do realize that they're controversial, but you so don't give a shit about what everyone else thinks that you put it in there anyways, because if anyone has a problem with it, then they're clearly wrong. Right? Like, that's, so I don't know. Rob Miller strikes me as, like, bullheaded and, I guess, like antisocial to the point where he would do something like that. But I'm willing to believe that he's not actually like a Holocaust denier or a Nazi. That's my read. Yeah. I don't know. What's your read?
My read is somewhat different than yours. I'm glad we have different opinions. As to Rob being hard-headed or bull-headed, he kind of is. I mean, he's an extremely talented musician, but if he's made up his mind about something, as far as I know, that's what he's made up his mind about. As to antisocial, I think you're he is antisocial in how you describe, but he's not antisocial in the concept of being unfriendly. Like if you email him, he'll email you back, or you know, like he knows how to talk with people. So it's not antisocial in the normal context or the usual context. It's in the context that you've described. However, my read is somewhat different. If you read the first and second statement, the form of writing, the cadence of the writing, and the style of writing is much, much different. The first post is extremely diplomatic. The second is calling Andy Lefton a Judas, which is Andy Lefton, as far as I know, is one of the nicest guys in punk rock, and so that I felt bad for Andy. Here's the point: is a musician that we're not going to name, but that we've talked about a lot on the podcast. He's a very variable person, and that sometimes I'll email him and I'll get back a very normal response, you know. And sometimes I'll get back this rambling response. And it's like he's talking about burritos, and then he's talking about TV shows, and he's talking about how certain people are out to get him, and then he's talking about, you know, The Price is Right. It's like, what are you, like, why do you spend 2 hours writing an email to me about this one sentence question that I had? It's like, and depending on the day or the week or the month, more like depending on the month, you might get two different versions of one person. And the reason I bring this up is this. Is in punk rock right now, we like to say mental health is so important. If your friend is struggling, you know, you need to reach out and help your friends, which is good. That's a great message to have. However, that message is somewhat sanitized. And when we say mental health is important, so if someone is sitting by themselves, or if someone doesn't email you back, or if someone has anxiety, you should help them out, which you should. However, that's only one form of mental health. I think probably the more common form, or the more serious form, is a form where people say whacked out things, are angry at you when they shouldn't be angry at you, and are just not acting rationally or sensibly, or they're just acting kind of extreme in all contexts. That's a mental health issue. And I've interviewed Rob a bunch of times. I'd like to think we're friends. I don't know if he would say I was his friend or not. We're at least friendly acquaintances. I've known Rob for about 15 years now. And I like Rob and I respect Rob. I'm very worried about Rob. Oh, I should – Holocaust denial is lame. Nazism is lame. We all agree that's all bad stuff. That's a – it's stupid and a bad idea. However, I'm worried about my friend Rob. I feel as though he's having a bad time. Maybe he's not doing well. And what frustrated me is all across the internet, people are like, well, Rob Miller's a jerk. Rob Miller's an asshole. I don't read the statement as someone that's been a Holocaust denier for 30 years and has finally decided to pull back the curtain and say, surprise, I got you. You know, I didn't believe in the Holocaust all along. What I get is someone that's kind of been studying some whacked out things, has gotten really into conspiracy theories, and has kind of gone over the ledge and is having trouble pulling himself back. And so for me, this is not the time to say Rob Miller's a prick, Rob Miller's evil. This is time to say Rob Miller's in trouble. Can we help him out? Because we owe him that, because of all the great art he's given to me, given to us, given to punk rock. If we can help him out, now is the time that counts to help someone out. The Rob Miller in these statements are not the Rob Miller that I know. And so when someone has a radical change, and this is a radical change in personality, is that a logical, systematic, say, I've made up my mind, the Holocaust didn't exist, that's my final word, or just someone that's kind of pivoting and spiraling out of control and probably needs help? And that's what I think it is. And so I think instead of damning Rob Miller, we should say, Rob, what you're saying is not cool, you're wrong, can we help you, can we help pull you back? And I think as punks, we owe that to him for all the great art that he's done. And as I said before, Holocaust denial is lame. Nazism is super lame. I don't think Rob's an evil person. I think he's in trouble, and I think he needs help. That's my read, especially. And honestly, Adam, like, the second statement actually kind of relieved me a little bit, and that it was much more whacked out than the first two that he put out. The third statement, rather, was much more whacked out than the first two. So to me, it's like, okay, this is a mental health issue. This is not a calculated person, if you will.
What the third statement really did for me is, to me, it really cemented how little I think his band knew about what the hell is going on.
They didn't know anything.
Right? The fact that, like, he calls them each out by name and, you know, and then...
That's so out of character. He's such a stoic person. He until this one statement, he has never come across as emotional, ever, you know, or overly emotional, you know. And this is so out of character for him.
Now, I mean, the read on this that I hope is not a good read is that, like, were this individual not a sort of like veteran artist that had been involved in communicating with the world for a long time. If this was just some guy on the internet that all of a sudden started talking like this and was involved in a, you know, Holocaust denial controversy, the read on it would be that, like, oh, this guy is just some, you know, this is some angry incel that took the red pill and you know, and got roped into the, I don't know, with a bunch of Jordan Peterson types and, you know, now is hanging out on the weird subreddits and complaining about whatever, right? Like, it reads almost in a way like a, what's the fucking word I'm looking for? It's not neckbeard, but there's something close, right? Like, it was one of these angry young men that has all of a sudden, you know, discovered their voice on the internet, and now they're incensed about everything, right? And if this was not like Rob Miller of Amoebix that we were talking about, if this was just like some guy from some band who was previously a nice guy has suddenly become this like whacked out, potentially Nazi adjacent, angry internet person, I think that like the 2019 read of that would have been like, oh, okay, well they've become one of these, horrible white nationalists. But that's, I hope that's not the take, because that just doesn't make sense.
I don't know that it's not. I'm hoping that it's not. You know, because he's got 40 years of history that say that's not the situation. You know what I mean? And so,
well, you come to that by being like a young, frustrated male that feels like impotent in the world, and that's your way of lashing out. I don't feel like you come to that by being like a respected musician that moved to Scotland to make swords in a cave.
But
then again, I've never lived the make swords in a cave lifestyle, so I don't know. I don't know what it makes you do.
Fun fact: he lives in the Isle of Skye, which has some of the oldest and deepest man-made caves on Earth. FYI.
Well, he may need to go hide in one for a while.
Honestly, I hope he cools it off for a while. I hope he gets better, if you will. And I hope the situation is salvageable for me and for punk worldwide. But honestly, subjectively, especially for me, I really want to enjoy this music again. And I want Rob Miller to come back to being the Rob Miller that I know. So what else can we say, Adam? Isn't incel so weird that like dudes like formed an organization and we can't get laid. Let's make it like that's so embarrassing to admit. You know what I mean? Like, I can't believe that was a movement for a while.
The internet allows for weird shit, John.
You sure it does. Here's some more weird shit. Here's some shit that might be equally as weird as incel. So there's a beer company called Foreign Objects Beer Company. They're releasing a new line of beers called Discord Beer, and the beer makes sour IPAs. Here's the weird thing that they did is they released an image of the Discord Records logo, but they changed the colors. And they called it Discord Beer. Now, they didn't actually put it on the beer bottle. They just kind of posted it on the internet. And, of course, as any of our listener probably knows, Discord Records was founded by Ian MacKay and Jeff Nelson. And Ian MacKay, without question, started the concept of straight edge, at least in punk rock. And so to use that imagery to promote a beer, it seems unwise, Adam. It seems unwise.
It's provocative. Was it intended as such, or was it just like a laugh that they put out that they did this. Because like you said, it's not actually on the labels of the well, the brew. I mean, well, we haven't seen any, all right? So it's
well, we know that it's not because they issued a statement that says it was, but maybe they planned to do it before they got busted. You know, but they were definitely damage control, unlike the guy we just spoke about, you know.
Yeah, they put out a statement that said, where is it here? The Discord image in question was created for Instagram as an homage to Discord Records. It was never intended for widespread use or as part of a press release. To cease all confusion, we have removed the image. So that's what they said there. I don't know. Is it, is this just maybe a situation where they were trying to be cute and
Here's what it, well, here's my take. Like, you know, bootlegging and punk rock is out of control. Like how many Misfits shirts with like the Eagles logo over it or you know, Milo, but it's Hank Hill instead of Milo or something. It's like out of control, you know. And I think these guys thought they were being cute. And I think – and let's face – you know, microbrews is pretty punk rock. I'm going to make my own beer. However, those guys are also capitalists, generally speaking, and capitalists tend to not care about art or other people or think twice about things. This logo is incredibly disrespectful. Anyone with half a brain cell knows – I mean, it'd be one thing if they did like the Epitaph record, Epitaph beer. You know, Epitaph isn't associated with straight edge. Discord is associated with straight edge more than anything else. So this is very disrespectful, and it just goes to show these beer guys are just assholes and they don't care, and they're jerks. And that's what I'm saying.
It's not making me mad or anything. It's just dumb. The dumb
makes
move.
Me mad.
It doesn't make me mad. It's just dumb. That's my read.
Yeah. One thing people said, see, it's like, you guys fell into their trap. It's like, they just wanted free PR. No company wants this kind of PR. And even if they do, it never works. Case in point, have we heard about Threaten? This is disastrous tour.
Oh yeah. Threaten. What are they up to?
Nothing. And people was like, you guys are falling into their PR trap. No, we're not, because we haven't heard anything from him since. So anyways, Adam, you want to talk about this music festival, or you want to break for a song? What do you want to do?
I'm not even sure what my take is on this fucking music festival. Let's do a song, and then we'll,
All right. Back. Adam, do you want to hear a synth punk song to match your synth punk song, or do you want to hear the Melvins and Flipper?
Oh, keep on the synth punk train.
All right, this is a band called Lotion. Lotion is P-U-N-K in that, like, even though Maximum Rock and Roll isn't around anymore, this is the kind of band that Maximum Rock and Roll would like. All the house show punks, they love this band, and with good reason. They're good. They're extremely abrasive, but this is a synth punk band called Lotion that just put out a new EP, and let's listen to a track off the new EP. And that's it's Lotion with periods between every letter. L-O-T-I-O-N, Lotion. Check it out.
That is the question.
we're back and we're already running long. Adam, even though it's just you and I assume we're out of the, we always go on and on, and we never keep on track, ever, you and I.
We're on track. We're pretty on track. We're talking about all the weird controversies and everything that...
Well, here's another weird controversy. There was a festival. Well, there's going to be a festival called Afrofuture Fest. It's August 3. I think it's in Chicago. Here's
Detroit.
Yeah. Here's the kicker. Tickets were through sale through Eventbrite, and you had two options. Well, you had four options broken into two categories: early bird or not early bird. The early bird ticket had two options. If you were a person of color, $20. If you're a white person – no, I'm sorry. If you're a person of color, $10. If you're a white person, $20. And then the non-early bird ticket, if you're a person of color, $20. If you're a white person, $40. That raised a stink, of course. And Eventbrite issued a statement that says, listen, we don't allow differing prices upon race. So they got – we sent them a letter saying – and actually Eventbrite was smart. Instead of just nuking it out – they said, all right, you got to change it or we will nuke it out. So they changed it to $20 for person of color, $20 for white person. And then after that, suggest donation for a white person, $20. So that was the response, I guess. The festival issued a short statement. They said basically their argument was is that because these kinds of festivals are – frequently visited by people of means, that means white people buy tickets and non-white people can't get in. And so that's why we're making it more expensive for white people. They got some threats, so they changed the thing and said, we got threats, so we're not going to – we got racist threats, they said, so we're not going to do pricing structure that way anymore. Meanwhile, a biracial singer backed out of the concert because she thought it was very insulting to her, I guess – for lack of a better term, white half, if you will, or however you want to phrase that.
Hold on. Was that the statement that the singer made?
No, the singer statement? The singer backed out. I forgot her name. She backed out. She said that because – I'll pull it up so we don't want to misquote it. But the gist of her statement was that because she was half white, she thought this was very insulting. I'll pull it up real quick, though, while you can talk.
Okay. Yeah, so like I don't know. I'm curious. I'm curious about how I even engage in this, because on the one hand, it is.
I'll read the statement real quick. Her name's Tiny Jag, and she said, "I was immediately enraged just because I am biracial. I have family members that would have, under those circumstances, been subject to something that I would not ever want them to be in, especially not because of anything that I have going on, a lot of the songs I perform are from my first project called Polly. That is my grandmother's name. How do you want me to come to a performance and perform those songs off a mixtape that is titled after this white woman that you would have charged double to get here? Like, it's just outrageous from so many angles." And that's Tiny Jag.
Okay, cool. So I wanted to make sure that we didn't put anything into her mouth there. This feels like a decision that was made by a committee of artistic directors that were trying to I guess, clever their way to solving a problem that I think is actually real, but not doing it in a way that was as fully thought out as it should have been. Wanting to encourage people of color or people that, especially people that maybe don't have the means of it, to attend your music festival is probably a real thing that they have to deal with. If you put together, say, something that is, if they put together an event that is really, you know, legitimately cool, cool lineup, interesting, you know, interesting branding, whatever else, right? If you put together something like that, you're going to attract a lot of people that are going to be people that are willing and able to travel to a cool, weird music festival and things like that. And I'm willing to bet that means you get a disproportionate amount of people who are showing up that are, you know, middle class white people that have the means to go travel to some hip, cool music festival. And that probably is a problem if the branding of your music festival is based on the fact that, you know, you've collected a bunch of, you know, innovative artists of African descent and have brought them in. Like, I understand their worry about the disparity there, where they don't just want to put together this kind of like celebration of Black culture and then have it be strictly attended by, you know, well-to-do college educated whites, right? I get why they would look at that and say, what do we do to get other people in? And I've seen that actually on like on a completely non-music level. You see that on this same problem approached by open source tech communities, where so they'll be conferences that they'll put on every year, where they'll say, okay, yeah, we're gonna go to this city and we're gonna rent a conference center for 2 or 3 days, and we are gonna do, you know, hang out and give talks about this software that we're communally putting together, and software that we think is actually going to be beneficial to the world, because it'll be, you know, something that people can use to create whatever they want. But then the problem that you have is that will disproportionately attract people like me, who are, you know, white people with the means to, you know, to fly out to Denver and go to a conference. So in the tech world, one of the solutions that they had for that was they would create, I guess they were, how were they phrased? They were phrased as like mentorship programs or sponsorship programs or something like that, by which, you know, if you were someone that was, say, from one of these quote unquote marginalized communities, and you wanted to, you know, attend this conference and get the most out of it, you could write one of these, you could write a little application that would get sent into a review board, and the review board would go and say, like, okay, like here's someone that we think would benefit from the knowledge we're trying to impart, but wouldn't actually be able to get here. So they get chosen as one of the people that can have either a discounted ticket, or they would get like some, maybe even if it wasn't a discounted ticket, they would get some extra guidance when they got to the event, where someone would, you know, show them around and introduce them to the right people and things like that. But basically it was something you would apply for, like applying for a grant almost. And, you know, you could use that to get to where you would be able to get otherwise with just money. And it was the same sort of intent with those conferences, where they're saying, like, we want a more diverse group of people here than just the people that we're obviously going to show up, or that history has shown will show up otherwise. So that's a different way of approaching, I think, the same, trying to square the same circle as this music festival has. But the music festival did, of course, not do it in a way that that the rest of the world seemed very cool with, and that kind of blew up in their face. But I've, you know, you've met these kind of people before, that, like, say, like, were, that are on the board of an artistic enterprise. You get a lot of artist types in there who will make a decision that has to do with commerce, but they'll come at it from more of a social justice standpoint, where what they're trying to do might not fly, but then they kind of revel in the potential controversy that decision creates. So yeah, I don't know. When I first saw this pop up, it did not make me mad.
It made me mad.
It made me mad. I saw it and I thought, all I could think of was, I'm like, that's going to blow up in their face. Like that's going to create the wrong kind of controversy. And I feel like I know what they're trying to achieve there, but it's just going to create the wrong kind of controversy. And, but I don't know. I'm not the kind of one that would make me, it just didn't make me mad. And I get the whole argument that, like, if the table was turned and it was, you know, it was like, oh yeah, we're creating this music festival where, you know, it's cheaper for whites to come to, but for everyone else, it's more expensive. Like, I totally understand why that would blow up in everyone's face, but I don't know. I've gone through my whole life without being, you know, very oppressed on most things. So it didn't make me mad. So maybe it should have. I don't know. It struck me as someone made a misguided decision trying to achieve something that is maybe would have been a good thing. That's, I don't know. Should I be more mad, John?
How mad can, there's stuff to get mad about all over the world. So should you actually get mad about this and think about this any second beyond reading the article? No, because honestly, there's stuff more local to you that you can get mad about that you should work on before working on this. You know what I mean? But that being said, this is a bad idea and very hypocritical. It's a bad idea, as Adam said. Well, what if you did white people are cheaper? That'd be extremely lame, of course. But then let's take it further. What if you did Italian people are cheaper? Because people with Italian backgrounds, historically and statistically, have a lower income than the average white person. So does that mean Italian people can get it? You know what I mean? But also, I'll also add that white people, at least in America, are not the wealthiest by race in America. You see? So how about the people that are wealthier than white people? Should we charge them even more? And how about the poor white people? Because there's lots of poor white people. I see them every day. Should poor white people have to pay for the rich white people? You know, I don't buy this dividing things by race. I was under the impression that, you know, since Martin Luther King and since before Martin Luther King, the idea was that you should look at a person for race. Maybe you want to look at them through economics, but not race. But somewhere in the past 10 or 15 years, we only look at race and say, well, if you are this race and you have these attributes, if you have that race and you have those attributes, which I think is entirely flawed. To a degree, I can understand how we got there, you know, because black people have a much higher chance of getting harassed by police and that kind of a thing. So I understand that. But this is not solving anything, and this is only driving the wedge further. And on top of that, I thought it was quite hypocritical, is this by definition is racist. If you are not white, you pay one price. If you're white, you pay more. That's racist. So then when people are being racist against them, they get angry. Like, not that it was cool. You definitely should not be racist against anybody. But if you're being racist, you can't get angry at people being racist against you. I find this to be incredibly misguided, short-sighted, hypocritical, and I think it's extremely lame. And also, as many people have said, what if you're half black, or what if you're three-fourths white and one-fourth black? Like, do we want to go back to the Civil War era where we look at what percentage of African history, African heritage a person is before deciding what kind of person they are? This is just asinine. You know what I mean? I can't get behind racism in any form. I can't get behind the idea of all white people have this attribute, everyone that's not white has this attribute. I can't get behind that either.
I agree with you entirely there. I'm curious of trying to parse out what was the intent, right?
I think the intent was just to be a prick. I mean, but who knows? I mean, maybe it was some sort of artistic statement, like you're saying, you know, so whatever.
Yeah, because I mean, like, I'm sympathetic to the idea of them wanting to ensure that the audience that is able to come to the show is representative, I guess, of the audience that would wish to come to the show, right?
Is that even a real problem, though? I mean, has there ever been, and maybe there has been, has there ever been a music festival where, say, black people couldn't get in because tickets were sold out before they could get to them? I don't know if that happened. You know what I mean?
No, but did
this festival sell out? Because it hasn't sold out yet. You know?
No, but I mean, I could. This is where I think that we approach this from. You know, we approach it from that kind of question, but that might not be it. The question may be like, if, and this is this we talked about there was a music festival in Europe, oh,
yeah,
right? That female,
yeah, yeah, right? Men couldn't get in on only women, which I actually thought was less offensive for some reason. I don't know why.
I think that the argument may be less about that, like, you know, oh, the tickets were all sold out to white people. I can see that the argument is something that's more along the lines of creating like a certain culture at the festival where people feel comfortable to be there.
So sure. We want to create zones where only certain races can go.
No, is that, about zones. What I'm talking about is that, like, what they're saying is that
I'm pretty sure there was a whole lot of politics in the United States in the 50s and 60s about that, Adam. And I'm pretty, and South Africa too.
Back up. Hold on. No, what I'm saying is that they're saying is, you know, perhaps there are people that are not going to feel comfortable coming to this festival if it's just like, you know, 6,000 John Gentiles standing in a room.
That is a pleasant area. John Gentile has never been rude to anyone at a festival ever. That would be a great festival.
I'm just saying. I don't know. I didn't organize this fucker. I'm just trying to think that, like, I'm trying to come up with what would be the intent. Because I'd like to think that...
I think the intent is he's an angry guy, and that this is how he's expressing his anger. And I think it's... He may be entitled to be angry, but this is not the right way to express that. That's how I read it. And we won't know unless we interview him, which I'm not going to do.
So anyways, yeah. So that is – oh, fuck. I was going to say that is the end of all the weird controversies and stuff like that we have to talk about this week. But it's not.
Let's do this one last – and then we'll end with a happy one. Let's do this one more controversy, and then maybe next week will just be a fun episode. So
okay, so which one do you want? You want Zex?
Yeah, let's talk about Zex. We don't have to drag this out. Zex is back. Zex, of course, was a band that had some real buzz in 2017. Here's what it was exactly. It was Vice Squad meets Plasmatics. That was Zex, and they were getting some real hype, especially in, you know, the Maximum Rock and Roll, you know, a house punk scene. In the same week, there was a slip up at a pressing plant, and their music was pressed onto a Beyonce record, which it was hilarious and amusing for all. However, the next day or the day after, it turned out that the guitar player Joe Capitalside was accused, but not found guilty, but accused of sexually assaulting multiple women, and some details came out that were pretty specific and pretty raw. Joe Capitalside doubled down and said, "Everything was consensual. You're all assholes. I might sue my old record label." He didn't, and then it appeared this was the end of the band. Now, 2 years later, they're back. They didn't address they didn't really address any of that at all. Joe Capitalside is still in the band. One member is gone. The other two are still in the band. The new album is called, Execute. And it's out next week. And Adam, as far as I can see, we're the only people that actually posted this story. It does appear that they've been either blackballed, which might be the right thing to do. I'm not defending – to make it clear, I'm not defending Joe Capitalside. I actually think he's a prick. I mean, as to the allegations, you can make your own – but I mean, the way he addressed his accusations was very lame, and I think that this band is lame to that degree. But this was a hype band in 2017. Now no one cares about them, and we're the only I think we're the only people that really kind of posted about them. And so the question is, should we even post about it, or should we, you know, put this band out to pasture and not mention them because they were – or one member was accused of being a pretty bad guy? Or is it just the hype over? Or are they suffering the bad – when you're a hype band, you get a short lifespan and that's it, you know?
Now, see, I don't remember the Zex hype prior to them like inadvertently getting into the press because of that Beyonce mix-up, right? Now, the fact that it all kind of blew up is – I'm entirely willing to bet that the rest of the punk scene has just decided to cancel Zex, right? In the parlance of our times, right? To tell the truth, I mean, here I can approach this directly as me being Adam, Mr. Canada music guy. I'm all dialed into the various PR universe that's pushing Canadian punk and garage rock and stuff like that, and I haven't heard anything about Zex from any quarter. And in particular, I mean, I think they're from Ottawa, and I am particularly dialed into what's going on in the Ottawa universe, and I've heard no one say anything about what's going on here. Now, that might just be because I'm dialed into the Ottawa universe, but I'm sure like on most things, there's actually like four levels of crust punk deeper than you think you're at. So maybe this is just like a few layers down the onion and I'm not aware of it. But my impression is that no one kind of wants to touch it. And I can say this also is like me as the person that writes this Canadian music newsletter. I don't really have any desire of to talk about it because I mean, for lack of a better thing to say, it's like I'm kind of scared of it. Like in that I don't need to go write about this and then all of a sudden have it come out that, you know, there's some horrible extra angle to these allegations or whatever. And now my content is all mixed up in their content. And suddenly I'm the only guy that's chosen to write about Zex, despite all the warnings that everyone else has backed off on. Right. So, you know, I'm not going to bother going at it, even though it should be something that's right up my alley. So there's that.
Really? You like this kind of music?
Well, I mean, like I write about, you know, guitar based, vaguely punky, you know, independent rock music as it is delivered to me. And sometimes that takes the form of, you know, guys in spiky shirts playing stuff. And sometimes that takes the form of like weird synth bands. Right. I try not to be too choosy about that as I'm writing. But yeah, this band's particular brand of punk is totally not my thing. But, you know, me writing about Canadian music, if there was no controversy and this all of a sudden showed up in my inbox, I would probably write about it. But yeah, I'm not gonna bother. It's potentially toxic. And as an independent, which is to say, you know, I'm not writing for a publication. I'm writing for me. There is a certain amount of, you know, again, going back to that record label thing, there's a certain amount of reputational risk about being involved in something that could turn out and blow up in my face like that. And maybe I don't want to do that.
I'm surprised they came back. You know, I thought like the guy's ballsy, you know?
Well, I mean, the fact that they came back in today's day and age when, you know, really famous people have like their whole careers, you know, obliterated for things that are maybe not, you know, that would have in the 70s just fucking flown right under the radar, right? The fact that they came back says either that like they really don't care and their fans really don't care, or, you know, but potentially that whatever the allegations were didn't pan out and they're just going to soldier on. Although it seems like in today's world, even when you have these allegations that don't pan out, you still, you still kind of have to change your name and go underground or something, right? It's like, you can't shake that usually. So yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of Zex, but it is curious to me why they have not crossed my inbox, given what I'm trying to do right now.
One reason is their PR is a person in Portugal who I get a lot of stuff from. So I think they probably went there because no one in Canada would touch them or America, you know. But also the people have spoken, they don't care. Only 300 views on YouTube. I mean, not that it's easy to get views on YouTube these days, but if you're a buzz band, you should be getting way more than 300. You know what I mean? So
the curious case of Zex. So anyways, yeah. So, that's it then. We have no more controversies, no more potential controversies.
It's easy sailing from here on out, Adam. Easy sailing.
Okay, so what do we do now? We go to bed. Can I go to bed? Let's go to bed.
Well, Adam, I'll do one quick one, and then we'll end with a happy one. How about that? One quick one, and we'll end with a happy one. How about that?
Okay. All right.
Are you seriously? Are you serious? Are you burnt out, or you want to do the last two?
I'm burnt out on life, John. Let's do it.
All right, I'll go real quick. Mad Magazine, Mad Magazine is coming to an end. I'm sad. After 67 years, the magazine will stop being on newsstands and will only be available at comic shops and through subscription. The kicker being that every issue will now be an archived issue of previously published material. Last year, the editorial board that had been the editorial board probably for about 30 years, roughly speaking, not counting a couple of guys, John Ficarra, Joe Ayola, and Nick Maglin, who were like the Mad Magazine guys for like 30 or even 40 years. They ended their relationship with, I don't know if they were fired, if they stepped down. I mean, they were, you know, John Ficarra, I think, is close to his 70s, and Nick Maglin passed away. He was like 88 or something. Dave Carrara's a young guy. He's only like 40 something, probably. Joe Ayola was probably about 50. The entire editorial board changed and the magazine shifted to California. It wasn't enough of a final push, and it's the end of the magazine. Mad Magazine is an amazing magazine, hilarious. I interned there, and it was cool. However, the problem that Mad Magazine faces, in addition to being a magazine, the entire internet is Mad Magazine now. You know, like, what's a meme? That's Mad Magazine, basically. You know what I mean? So I guess it's just been made obsolete, unfortunately. But however, as with many things that have been made obsolete, the craftsmanship and cleverness in a meme, the craftsmanship and the cleverness in Mad Magazine is not found in a meme, if you will. So it's sad, and well, what can you say? I'm sad. It's a great magazine. I'll miss it for sure. I still have a subscription.
It's incredibly hard to have a magazine, like a paper magazine that exists in today's day and age. And Mad seems like Mad has always seemed to be like such a product of a media landscape that doesn't exist anymore that to be honest, I was sort of surprised that it was still around to this point, which is not a knock on Mad, just like a knock on like the universe. Like,
yeah.
Honestly, I'm surprised that any magazine manages to still exist ever. So
the crazy thing, if you go to like a bookstore or whatever, there's still like a ton of magazines you've never even heard of. You know what I mean? Like, who's buying these magazines?
I'm shocked. Like, I'm convinced there is some secret subsidy that is keeping magazines in business. It's like the corn subsidy or something. Like, the U.S. government has to figure out what to do with all this corn that they've paid for. So they're using it they're making it into magazines, and that's the way it exists, but it couldn't exist in any other economy or something like that. Like, there is some strange, you know, Malcolm Gladwell turns out truth about why magazines still exist.
Fun fact I learned about Alfred E. Newman. Alfred E. Newman was not created by Mad Magazine. He actually existed before Mad Magazine. He was included in Mad Magazine because he was named by Mad Magazine, but this character or a version of this character was seen on a postcard that they incorporated into the magazine, and he became the mascot after about a year or two. That image on a postcard goes back to the 1800s, which goes back even further. Alfred E. Newman, and this is true, Adam, Alfred E. Newman at least goes back to the 1800s, and he might even be just a depiction of the ancient European concept of the fool. That is, Alfred E. Newman might be a millennial, two millennial, three millennial old archetype. Isn't that crazy?
I did not expect you to have that fact. I have nothing to say.
That's crazy. Like, I think that's so cool that Alfred E. Newman actually might be a character that's been around for 3,000 years or 2,000 years. Like, he might be – have you seen The Wicker Man? That might be it. Alfred E. Newman, the fool. That's crazy. You know, or he might be Punch, you know, from Punch and Judy. Like, that's crazy. That's so neat. That's so interesting. And no one knows for sure, like, a lot of that stuff.
Alfred E. Newman is the original trickster god. All right. So that's – you had one more.
All right, this is just fun. Asian Man Records is going to put out a new album by a new band called Grumpster. Grumpster, they look pretty young. I don't know how young they are, but they're in the Bay Area. Their new album is coming out on Asian Man. It's called Underwhelmed, and it's going to be out in early November. They haven't put out any singles, but their last single is called Strangers. And actually, it's very good. I was surprised at how good it is. One thing I just want to add about this is, man, I'll tell you, man, like, I think one of the flaws of punk news is I think we do get too dedicated to some labels. We're like, oh, this label is great. Everything they do is great. There's no label where everything they do is great, you know? And I think sometimes we get too slavishly dedicated to a label because it's fun to be a part of the action, if you will. That being said, props to Mike Park, and here's why, Adam. Mike Park, out of the blue, like the last four or five or six or seven albums that he's put out are not by bands that people know. He's been putting out albums by bands that, like, no one knows, like, admittedly, you know, and that's – I don't know how he's making any money, you know? Like, it's tough to make money on an album by a band that no one knows. You know, it's really tough. And Mike Park famously doesn't pay for any PR at all. So, man, he's doing it for the love of the art, and you got to commend that. You know, what can I say? Do you think that's some kind of plan he has, Adam, to like beat the current like music economy and the current system, or do you think he's just putting out stuff he thinks is cool?
Mike Park, as far as I'm concerned, is the only virtuous person left in the music universe. So I think he's doing it for all the right reasons, and I mean, I don't know how he's paying for it. So
maybe, yeah, that's what I'm saying, man. It's like I just got a long term, you know what I mean? I just got a long term plan, you know.
I mean, I don't want to start a rumor on the Punk News podcast that Mike Park is secretly, you know, importing most of the cocaine into the United States, and that's what's funneling his record label. But whatever it is, I hope he doesn't get busted.
Well, and if he does, I hope he doesn't take his anger out on Adam for tipping off the fence.
Yeah. But oh man, I mean, Mike Park has been like, I mean, I've said this on the show before. I had to sit down at one point and as some sort of thought exercise, write down like what I wanted my life to be like in, I don't know what it was, like 2020 or something, or like 10 years from now. Like, what I want my life, like, it is not 10 years from now for 2020, of course, right now. But like, I did
2020
this,
is next year, Adam.
Yes, I know. I did this a while ago, right? Where I had to write like what do I want to be? Like, what do I see myself? You know, people write down and be like, oh, I want a big house and a cool car and lots of money in the bank and go on lots of vacations or whatever the fuck they put. I literally wrote, I want to be Mike Park. And that was the only way I could encompass like what I would want to become in the world. Because like, I look at what Mike Park's doing and the dude has always done. And like, you can't fuck with the love that guy has for music and how he's been able to help shepherd it out into the world and how he's been able to help independent artists and musicians and stuff like that. And Mike Park is wonderful.
I don't know how he's put out. Mike Park's a good guy. Definitely. I don't know how he's put out records that no one's ever heard of and making money. Cause I know other labels that do that and they lose a lot of money, but Mike Park doesn't operate like other labels. So, you know, anyway, I hope it works for him.
Yeah.
Me too. The band's cool. So, cool. Adam, we made it through the trauma. We made it through the heartache.
Oof, we did. All right. So are we checking out? Are we done?
We're checking out, baby. I can't take it anymore. Next week will be comedy week here at Pug News.
Yay. All right. It'll be super fun. Yeah. Cause you know what? I had a really stupid intro for this show. Okay. If it was going to be my turn to host, and it was dumb. It was the height of dumb comedy. So maybe I'll break that out next week because it's going to be stupid. So everyone's got that to look forward to.